the races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour two, and Arno Delacour is going to join us, and we've also got to catch up on Friday at Belmont, too. There was a few notable performances. And how about yesterday, by the way, the Tom Albertrani winner that is obviously going to be a major horse going forward here. It's kind of slipped in. Faya, the Frisian Faya, originally bred by Ann Merriman and Bob Masiello, moving over to Tom Albertrani. And this this gelding, this looks like a star in the making. So we'll talk about that. Right now, though, Arno Delacour joins us to talk about the import that, you know, kind of jumped off the page, I think, at everybody. We discussed it. Arno, you might have seen some of the chatter. I mean, you're busy training the horses, but it was seemed pretty obvious on Wednesday when this field was drawn that Magic Attitude might be something special coming out of the French Oaks and competing at a high level. And then she goes out and in her North American debut lives up to a little bit of the expectations, wins the Grade One Belmont Oaks. Congratulations to you and Javier and to the Jacksons.
Thank you very much. Wonderful win. As you said, it set up very well. You know, for her, all the conditions were great. We had a firm turf, which she'd appreciate, and a short field, so she delivered.
There's a few parts of this that we always love to hear the backstories and, you know, the intricacies of bringing horses, you know, from other parts of the world. What was your impressions of her, you know, upon arrival? And, you know, she had a very limited work tab down by you at Fair Hill. Obviously the record kind of spoke for itself, but tell us about the filly when you first laid eyes on her.
Well, it's kind of a work in progress. The Jackson bought her, you know, when she won her Grade 3, which was the Prix Vento, I believe, and left her in France. So the trainer in France, Fabrice Chappé, obviously did a great job to bring her along. And I pretty much follow his instruction, and that's all we did, you know. Told me that she didn't need tons of work. She was a great filly. We could do everything we wanted, and she was better covered up. So we did exactly what he said, and it worked out.
How about that? And so that included, just four timed works, just easy 3/8, and then three easy half miles. The way in which she ran that European style where she kind of, I don't want to say languished, but she was obviously in no hurry early. What did you tell Javier in terms of, the kind of trip to work out and when to produce her, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, first of all, Javier watched his replay, the replays in France. So, I mean, he told me in the paddock, I've watched the races so many times that I feel I already know her, you know. So that's one thing. And also, we praised her enough in the morning to realize that if, you know, she needed to be covered up, she could be pretty aggressive if you put her head and head with another horse. But if you put her behind a horse, she would drop a bit and do whatever we wanted. So that we had kind of a test for it in the morning. After that, it's pretty obvious that she needed to be covered up, otherwise she was going to do too much.
Arno, flesh that out for a second, because that's really amazing when you think about it. That a horse that if she's got the open space, you know, when the open space is in front of them, and they you know, they go forward aggressively. I mean, the way this, you know, the way this happened, but it can't be that easy. If a horse is naturally aggressive, it can't be just as simple, right?
Unfortunately, some of them are not. Some of them, they can see the light and they're going to stop anyway. But for that particular filly, with the schooling she had in France, I would say, because it's not something that happened overnight, you know.
Right.
Obviously, they've been working with her since she's like two, or even as a yearling. And my guess is that what they've really been like focusing on teaching her, you know.
Amazing. And you know, it's a question then of tandem training and you know, getting them out on the gallops and putting them behind the horse to try to teach them to relax.
Yeah, exactly. And then you, after that, there's a few adjustments to be made. They either have a turn of foot, and then you can just make sure that they stay behind and they'll produce. And if they don't really have much turn of foot, well, we change a few things, which mean like we put them, you know, they need to be more forwardly placed. So that's something that can be addressed in the morning also.
Amazing. And the way she accelerated and basically got to the field in, I mean, it was less than a 16th of a mile as Javier, you know, tipped her out. And watching her finish, it feels like, you know, she can be switched off for any distance. It doesn't appear that any one configuration or any one trip is going to be better for her than another.
Yeah, I agree with that, because that was minor quarter, but if you look at the race, she broke on top. Ravia took her back, but if the pace would have been a little bit, you know, stronger or anything, she could have been right there with them. That was just not what we wanted to do going minor quarter, but, you know, she broke on top, so it's not like if she's not alert and sleeping. So it's, but I agree with you. It's pretty amazing when they can deliver a turn of foot like that. It's kind of a very good feeling as well for a rider, because you know that you're passing off it. So that's a great feeling.
How many Galileos have you had in the barn so far?
She's the first one.
She is the first one.
So we've been privileged to, you know, obviously Galileo's record speaks for itself. I think it was his 89th individual Grade 1 winner or something like that. I've read somewhere.
So unbelievable.
That's pretty amazing. And to have a filly like her by Galileo makes it even more special.
For the Jacksons, you know, obviously long term, there's broodmare potential and so forth. But you know, when you mentioned the firm turf, it was that part of the decision to bring her, because they're happy to campaign horses in Europe.
Yeah, I think it was also the right time. I mean, you know, the division in Europe, and there's a lot of races for 3-year-old fillies or 3-year-old colts.
True.
And then when come the fall, you need to run against older. So we have the chance in America to have a program that keeps going for a little bit with 3-year-old fillies, and you can wait until you face other competition. So it made a lot of sense to bring her, you know, to bring her to the state in the middle of the summer, and aim for the races in the fall. So I'm glad it worked out so far.
What kind of a filly is she to be around?
She's very nice. She's not very big. But she's, as my wife would say, because she rides there, she's got it. Like, you tell her what you want to do, and she does it, and she does it impressively.
Wow.
Sweetheart around the barn, you know, anybody can walk her, do anything. She's very nice. Sometimes when you bring horses from Europe, there's a little bit of an adjustment to be made at the gate, because nobody stands with them in the gate in Europe.
Right. Right.
So they can be a little fractious or just like a little shy about it. And since day one, we've been to the gate, and she just looked at everybody, climbed and stuff, and she really didn't care, which is probably a good thing. I mean, the other day, I think the horse on the inside on Saturday was kind of, you know, a little fractious in the gate, and it didn't bother her at all. So that's a huge quality.
You bring up a tremendous and very salient point. And in fact, Andy Serling talks about this a lot, that the European horses, when they come here, very often they kind of walk out of the gate as well. They aren't drilled to break sharp the way North American horses are. And, you know, depending on a horse's style and aptitudes, that can work against them. I mean, if it's a horse that needs to be forward, a lot of times you see those Euros, they sort of like just kind of take one little hop out of the gate, and it takes them a jump or two to get their feet under them.
Right, right. And that's often the case, you know. But once in a while, you just have like a genuinely like fast horse from the gate. But the schooling in the morning is not as important over there than it is. And I mean, you can look at, you know, a couple of like a maiden race in France going 6 furlongs. Well, they break and everybody wants to take back to teach their horse something. While in America, it would be the opposite. If you go 6 furlongs, you break on top, you stay on top.
Absolutely.
So that's a little bit of a different approach there.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, there are races like the Queen Elizabeth and so forth, but is there Breeders' Cup interests in the meantime?
I think that would be a big step, you know, to face older fillies that are very well the season for her. I mean, I'd look at any option and speak to the Jackson about it, but if we have a race like the you know, Queen Elizabeth, or even the Epitello, or races like that, we should keep our option open. I'm not sure, the Epitello is against all their fillies, but I'm not sure who's going to show up from Europe with the COVID situation. So, you know, we're trying to be opportunist a little bit and try to find the best spot for her.
Well, obviously, it's exciting to have a filly of like this, and basically, you know, to instantly capitalize on the opportunity and the promise, and you know, certainly in your and Lee's hands, not a surprise at all. And so, the Jackson's Magic Attitude, the Galileo filly, bred by Mr. Yoshida. Clearly going to be a major player going forward, not just as a, you know, the rest of the 3-year-old season, but you mentioned too, should bring up with Arnaud Delacour, you mentioned maybe going up for the EP Taylor, and we talked earlier with Kevin Attard, and he's got a couple of potential players for the Taylor, and you sent Châtelet up for the Woodbine Cares Saturday.
Yes, we did. It was a bit ambitious. She ran pretty well the first time, going 5 furlongs on the turf. Considering her breeding, I guess we wanted to take a shot and see if we could get her sixth place. Probably a big step up for her. But she came back well, and we can. She'll be able to win some races here. You know, we were just trying to take advantage of the program right now.
No, understood. And, you know, 2-year-olds, one of my favorite owner breeders, too, Ed Seltzer. And this is an Into Mischief filly that went up as a maiden, but why not try? And you got so many places that are available to you. Obviously, Arno, when you're at, all you have to do is look at, you know, between Delaware and the Mid-Atlantic and up to New York, out to Presque Isle. I mean, you've got 7 or 8 condition books sitting on the desk.
Yeah, I like the geographic position of Fairhill. That makes it a little bit easier. And that seems to be also the new face of horse racing, where you need to be flexible and go where be able to ship to find the best spots. So that's something that is even probably a little bit easier at Fairhill. We don't depend on any jurisdiction, so it's pretty much we go wherever we want. So that's a big help for sure.
How did you handle the Kentucky Downs horses? Did you send them out as a group or you know, because it's a ship in meet? So where were the horses? Because you ran 3 or 4 Kentucky Downs.
I think we ran a little bit more than that, maybe 8.
That many? Wow.
Yeah, so I sent a team of people, you know, like one assistant and a groom and a rider over there. And we were sending the horses back and forth. So the horses wouldn't stay there more than one or two nights. I mean, obviously, one of the card was canceled, so we had to wait like an extra 2 days to run. But the logistic was pretty easy. We've got great people working for us as well as like great van company. So they do a pretty good job to get them there like as fast as they can, because you don't want to waste too much time in shipping.
No.
It worked out pretty well.
Well, and I suppose one of the best performances came at a big price, that 30-1 shot. Luck Money ran a big race. That was in the that Oaks set with Micheline of Mike Stidham's, who we talked to last week, and Harvey's Little Goal. You had to be very encouraged by Luck Money.
Yes, we thought that the distance would be probably a good thing for her, the extra distance on minor quarter. Unfortunately, there's not that many races that are available, so we decided to take a shot. Javier won a great race, was really happy with the finish. Only got beat, if I remember the shot, like a length and a quarter or three quarter, something like that. So that's very promising, and she won a very good race, I agree.
You know, that's Mrs. Wills, Dr. Wills, we should say, and she's had some nice horses. How long have you been training for Catherine Wills?
Well, that goes back to she had horses with Christophe.
Yeah.
When I was working for Christophe, so you know, horses that didn't quite fit New York when we started to train, Christophe would be kind enough to recommend us. And that's how we started. So pretty much, I'd say the first horse we trained for her was in 2008, a year after we started training.
Nice.
And she's been very good. She's an honor breeder, so there's a lot of things that she understands. First one being patience, because it takes a long time to get rewarded in the breeding game, and she does the right thing. So, yes, that's really enjoyable to work with Catherine.
No, I've seen her horses for a long time. Well, and, if I'm just looking, as much success as she has had, she has only ever been graded stake place. She has not won a graded stake. You got to get Dr. Wills a graded stake, Arno. We're putting that on you. Make it happen.
Not for lack of trying.
Not at all.
But I would say that graded stakes, especially grade one, are tough to win. So when we win it, we don't take it for granted. We just enjoy it.
I'm going to bring up another terrific performance. Even finishing fourth, Eons is one of my favorites. We've talked about any number of times, and he ended up fourth, beaten, I don't know, a handful of lengths, but he was 30-40-1.
Yes, I was very pleased with the race. I'm not sure that the soft turf was exactly what he wanted, but it was soft for everybody else in the race, so I'm not making up excuses. But for first time going mile and a half, I thought he did a very good show. I would try to keep him probably at that distance, and he'll probably get better at that distance after running a couple of more times and realize that, you know, we want him to take his time a little bit more. He was a bit aggressive the other day, but still ran a very good race.
He's a nice horse. And, you know, speaking of nice horses, I want to ask about the Curlin filly. And you're probably one of those trainers that wishes Kentucky Downs would have a lot more dates, because Cambaliza, last year she breaks her maiden at Kentucky Downs. Then you send her back and she wins an allowance at Kentucky Downs.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And both times she won under an inquiry. So there's a little bit of a luck involved also. But yeah, she really like that. But she's typical of a filly that really wants to go a little bit of, needs more ground. And as much as I like the location of Fair Hill, there's not a lot of option in the Mid-Atlantic to go, you know, mile and a quarter or even mile and a half, which is really what she needs. So it's nice to be able to it's nice to have those meets like Kentucky Down to be able to test them over the distance at the Nalorance level or Maiden level last year, which is really difficult to find.
What kept her on the sidelines, Arno? She basically was sidelined 7, 8, 9 months.
Yes, well, we did a checkup on her before we gave her some time, and there was a few issues that needed to be addressed. Nothing major, but really the Runnymede, the owner of Runnymede, they already wanted to prep Kentucky Down again. So they told me it's like the objective is Kentucky Down. So take your time. We don't have to run. I mean, maybe once or twice before to prep the race. But it'll be great to aim for that meet. So that's what we did, and it worked out.
Well, and it, you know, considering that was her second off the layoff, gotta, I suppose, take advantage. You know, while she's in top form, is there something at Keeneland maybe for her, or you know, do you look up? What EP Taylor would suit her too? No.
Yeah, it's probably a little short for her. I really would like to run her mile and a half, and there is another one, second level another one at Keeneland, going mile and a half, which would be probably a perfect race for her.
Very nice. Well, let me also mention a couple of others that either came close or are going to, you know, be worth following. Medita with a nice second. Going back in that one dreamer on the opening day card.
Yeah, it's very encouraging. She's always showed a lot of potential in the morning. She's not an easy filly. She needs to be covered up. The last time she ran at Belmont, we didn't have quite the trip we were hoping for. She was in the clear all the time. You know, we were talking about that earlier with Magic Attitude. And was always doing a little too much and pretty much came empty at the end. So she's really a filly that needs to be ridden like not like Magic Attitude, because she's a little more aggressive than Magic Attitude, but she needs to be covered up for sure. So we'll see. But that was a very good race from her at Kentucky, and I was very happy with that.
Medita, the German bred, and let's get a catch up on where things stand with the lovely Chalon. It seems like her graded stake days are maybe behind her, Arno, or does she still have a big effort or two in her for that?
She's probably a nudge below what she was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, when she was second in the Breeders' Cup, she's still very performant and very sound and happy to train and stuff. But I'm kind of choosing my spot wisely with her, just because she's, I think she's like 10,000 short of $1 million, something like that. So it'd be nice to find the right spot and get it done with her. So I'm considering running her, even try her on the turf one time, because she's never done that. So maybe that's something that would give her a little bit of, you know, another dimension to her resume. So I'm thinking about doing that. We'll see.
Well, she's 8,000. She's $8,105 away from being a millionaire.
Right. So that would be nice to get to that.
Absolutely. That high. She's wonderful, and I could see, you know, things like the Dashing Beauty, and you know, she would. It's too bad that we lost the Match Series, Arno, because she could have run in all the Match Series races.
Yes, she would have been tough. She would have been tough this year because she won a few of those. I mean, like races that would have been in the Match Series. So yeah, no, definitely, but I see it like she doesn't owe us anything, really. She's done great. She's very consistent. So we're just trying to find the right spot for her.
Well, and finally, let me ask you about a starter that's coming up, I think, on Wednesday, and that's Peachy Keen. This is a Leal, will take charge colt that got a little bit of a late start to his career. He's a three-year-old, and he debuted in August at Delaware Park.
Yes, we're running him, knowing that, you know, 6 furlongs would be a little short for him. He's really going to be a two-turn horse. Late developing, we gave him plenty of time. he's coming along. We put blinkers on Wednesday just to wake him up a little bit and try to have him a little bit closer. You know, I think he'll run well. I mean, I'm not sure I would win. He needs to, you know, obviously step up compared to his last race, but I'm expecting a good effort.
And I'm going to ask you, too, about on Wednesday at Presque Isle, Royal Collection, the Munnings filly, the Jackson homebred, comes back off the maiden win. And Royal Collection, out of the very nice Stormy Atlantic mare, My Princess Jess. And, you know, feels like this was a filly. You know, she's also three-year-old. Feels like she was cut out to be a nice one.
Yes, I was very high on her at the beginning. And we ran her the first time going two turns on the turf. And that would probably be more like, because I was looking at the pedigree and My Princess Jess, as you mentioned, and the rest of the family. But she didn't run as well as we expected her to. So we came back sprinting, and she's been much better doing so. And also, we tried her on the tapeta, and it seems that that she really appreciated the surface.
Well, and the horses, you know, horses that have shown an affinity at all for Presque Isle, for the Tapeta, absolutely. They seem to stay sound, and they run very regularly out there. It's a great surface. Well, a lot of good things going on in the Delacour barn, but the arrival of Magic Attitude going to be, you know, certainly heralded going forward. Arno, congratulations again to you and the Jacksons, to Lee and everybody involved, and we'll look forward to, you know, the potential. You know, down the road, Breeders' Cup or whatever it's going to be, and so many other good things happening in the barn.
But thank you very much.
Always fun to talk to Arno Delacour, and there's another. He's got another half a dozen horses from the summer that seem like they're going places, and you know, either maiden winners or horses that came and you know, came out and got the season started. You know, a little delayed, but, you know, so many people dealing with that. And then I'm sure there's plenty of two-year-olds yet to come out of the Delacour barn. We're going to stay here. Second half of the morning, Grant Forster is going to join us, I think, at the top of the hour. Rich Migliori is somewhere out on out on the trails in the Catskills, and Casey, try Richie now. He says he just came out of the woods. Call him now. He says he just sent me a text. He just came out of the woods, and literally out of the woods. So Rich Migliori, who we couldn't connect with at the end of Saratoga, we kept missing, and wanted to catch up with Mig. And there was a couple of things that I had for him, including it came up last week, flashing, right? Flashing came up, the Godolphin mare. But when she was a filly, and I'm pretty sure, I don't want to forget this, I made a mental note to bring it up. It was that horse Crump that was that we had discussed, and that was with Stidham, and I'm pretty sure it was Mig's last Grade One winner. I think, but we'll ask him. And here he is, right on time. Rich Migliori, somewhere in the Catskills, somewhere between the Nevelly and Grossingers.
Yeah, no, I'm not that far west. I'm a little more northern Catskills, but I did one hike already. I'm not satisfied physically yet, so I'm going to another one. And as soon as I get to a place where I can pull over, I'm going to park the car because I'm afraid I'm going to lose you up here.
All right, cool. Well, then we'll get our gig in. And before I forget anything else, ears may have been burning or maybe even heard me when we were talking to Stidham, and a horse of his by the name of Crump came up, and I saw that he was out. He's an It's a Mischief colt that was out of Flashing, and immediately, Flash. Right, it flashed in my head that she might have been your last Grade One winner.
And she was the last Grade One winner of my career when she won the Gazelle. It was still a Grade One at that point. And I was actually on air when he ran at Churchill. And I said to Greg Wolf, I said, well, they named this one Crump because not too long after I won the Gazelle on the mother, my career crumpled.
Jesus. You need a new gag writer is what you need. That Jesus, that was awful. She was terrific. I remember at Saratoga too. Right, she won the test that
year.
Yeah,
you know, and it was really satisfying with her, Steve, because she could be very difficult. She would want to get rank, and she could really bear out. And she had actually bore out badly in the Mother Goose when she was well beaten by Rachel Alexandra. And Javier Castellano rode her that day. And Rick McKee asked me if I would work her. And, you know, no guarantee I was going to ride her, just to kind of help out and see if I could figure something out with her, because I had done good work with them with Afrashad, who was the rankest horse I had
run
in my life. Yeah, he was. That was a whole other level of rank, and wound up getting him where he was somewhat manageable and won some stakes on him. But so I worked with her in the morning, and I got to a point where she didn't get out with me. She was kind, and so when she won the test, it was very rewarding because we even got her to come from a little off the pace. And then it was my suggestion to run her in the Gazelle. They didn't think she'd stay 9 furlongs. And I was like, I think she'll go to the lead and relax and never look back. And then she did it. So it was, like I said, very satisfying on a lot of levels to work with a horse. You know, because as a rider, you know, there's a lot of horses, the first time you see them is when you come to the paddock. So to have a hand in that development was particularly satisfying.
Well, and you're making me think of two things that I can bring up as a follow-up. We just had Arno Delacour, and we talked to him about the really impressive performance of Magic Attitude on Saturday in the Belmont Oaks. And I know people, you know, were disappointed that it wasn't a bigger field. You know, I think this weekend we're going to get a bigger group in the Derby, the Belmont Derby. But this group, say what you will, this was an impressive horse. And I'm not sure it would have mattered if there were another three or four in here. She was everything we kind of were expecting, I think.
She was dazzling. I mean, she couldn't have been more impressive. What a turn of foot for not a very big filly to be able to accelerate the way she did. You know, no pace on whatsoever. Antoinette, you know, getting the same trip she got when she won the Saratoga Oaks and got comfortable on the lead with Johnny. I mean, that's when I get excited, when you see a horse that can turn it on like that. And you know, like Artie Schiller could give you an ace to 3/16ths, like gangbusters like that. She did it like for a full quarter of a mile. I mean, that was very, very impressive.
Well, and one of the things that came up with Arno was he says that, you know, that she is a filly that is eager. And you know, the instructions that came with her from Europe included, you know, the imperative of getting her behind horses to get her to switch off. But I had to ask Arno to expand on that. And of course, his wife Lee is the exercise rider. There's some challenge to that. It isn't just natural that if a horse is naturally aggressive, that, you know, you just put them behind horses one morning and now you're all set. They'll relax behind horses. That's got to be taught to them.
Well, yeah, but they train a great deal like that in Europe. Well, they'll put them nose to tail and don't let a horse see all that empty, expansive racetrack in front of them where they get excited and want to go. And if you go back and watch the start, Javier pretty much stopped her the second or third step,
right,
to make sure like he could get her behind horses. And then she actually, you know, did it well. Like, you could see she was all there. You know, she was in the bridle, but she wasn't, you know, running off or getting, you know, rank with him where she was throwing her head. So he did a really good job kind of, you know, stopping her those couple of steps and making sure he covered up. But without, you know, the lack of pace that was on in that race, and he must have been just getting all the right feelings because he was just so confident. You could just see he was like, I'm going to win. It's just a matter of when I turn her loose. And when he tipped her out, boy, it was fun to watch that acceleration.
Yeah, and then there's part two of this kind of learned behavior. And did you follow the story of that River Crossroad RVF at Charlestown? Well, this is the crazy. I mean, this is that horse. You probably saw the video. The horse that veered for the opening. They had the wall open. And
yes.
Well, he did it again the other day. He did it in the summer in July. Then he ran okay, and then he did it again the other night. And now Charlestown's had no choice but to rule him off, because you can't have a horse that's, you know, taking right turns and heading for openings wherever they may be on the racetrack. So, you know, Jeff Runco, who's, you know, plenty accomplished, is dealing with this. And I was reminded, you know, people are, you know, saying different things about these kinds of incidents. I was reminded of a horse. And this is not so unusual as it might sound, but horses, Rich, that break and then stop and go back behind the gate.
Well, we've seen that over the years. One of the most famous ones of that was Rubiano's mother, Ruby Slippers. She was, you know, ran three or four times. I believe Sydney Waters was training her for the Firestones, if I'm not mistaken, and she had won a couple races, and then she decided one day, nah, I'm not doing this. And she had post one, and she broke, went one or two steps, and wheeled, and went back behind the gate, and she wound up being the dam of Rubiano.
Well, it is, you know, this incident with this horse. You know, we understood in July when he veered off and headed for the opening, you know, to go back to the barn. This is one problem. I mean, he was on the lead, and when he did it, this behavior, the horses that do this with the gate, this is a huge problem, and it has, you know, one after another has had their gate card taken away, and you know, basically been ruled off. Gary got one that Bobby Flay owned, and was having that problem. With the gate would open and would take two jumps and then turn and go want to go back behind the gate, and Gary worked and eventually got Mocha Shake. I'm almost positive was the name of the horse, and got Mocha Shake to stop doing it and go on and at least break a maiden or win a race. I remember, but big problem.
Opens up this opens up another avenue of conversation, if you'll indulge me, because you know, the ruling now, Monmouth Park next year, no, you know, riders won't be allowed to use the whips or riding crops except for safety measures. Which, how is a rider going to explain when he feels a horse do something, but you don't see him do it, and he's got to react? You know, because you feel a horse, you know, kind of start to put his toes in the ground or start to cock his head a certain way, and you know he's going to do something drastic, and you'll, you know, react and pop him on the shoulder and holler at him to get their attention again. How are they going to enforce that when a rider, you know, has to go on instinct and feel? You know, you can't wait for a horse to start to do something and then think you're going to correct it. And I really think they're making a dangerous game that much more dangerous with these, to me, pandering decisions.
Well, you know, I asked Tony on Thursday to, you know, to touch on it, and you know, I guess we won't know the ramifications until, you know, we start to we start to see incidents. But you bring up a couple of sidebars on that topic, which includes, you know, the internet and people, you know, taking snippets of races and determining that guys are stiffing horses because they're dealing with something that you know, the public really can't see or understand, whether it's, you know, whether it's equipment going wrong, whether it's the stirrup, whether it's, you name it, any variety of things that a rider is dealing with that, you know, people, you know, sitting watching video just aren't going to understand. And this is only going to get more pronounced when you've got this kind of a circumstance and the fact that, you know, riders are going to be conditioned out of, you know, not using their stick. It's problematic. And then I love the people that say, oh, just ride without sticks. There's no need for them.
I think as a whole, the industry, us, have done a poor job of educating and then to make decisions, you know, based on people that are uneducated about our industry to placate them is the problem. And, you know, riders don't ride with long stirrups. You know, the basics of riding, you know, your legs are one of your aids. Well, to be aerodynamic and to be more effective weight-wise with a horse to be on their withers, a rider rides with much shorter stirrups. So he's already given away one aid, which is his legs, his seat in a lot of respects. Now you want them to take away the crop, which is another aid. So now you've got your hands and your voice. So you've given away two of your four aids. I mean, I'm just, honestly, I'm just glad I don't ride anymore because, you know, people are making decisions about this that really have never done it. And to, again, you know, play to a base of people that have never done it and don't understand it. And maybe, again, it goes back to us. We never educated people well enough.
To be honest, there's certainly a group that out there that aren't interested in being educated about anything.
Yeah.
They've determined that the Ortiz brothers are laying out how to cheat in the jocks room, Rich. That every race that they that they should be separated. That's my favorite. That they shouldn't be allowed to ride the same circuit.
That's just, it's such an absolute joke, and it really does speak to ignorance, and, you know, what you're saying is correct. I guess for some people, ignorance is bliss. They just decide that, you know, this is this conspiracy theory, and we're going to go with that, and nothing could be further from the truth. You want to see two guys that, man, they want to win so bad, and, you know, I was watching them in Saratoga. They'd be out by the paddock on a picnic bench at 6 o'clock in the morning, seeing if anybody needed them to get on horses because they couldn't go roam the backstretch, but horses would come through the paddock. And winning at the rate and percentage they were winning at, and they're out there doing that. I mean, work ethic unparalleled. You've got to admire it. You've got to respect it. And people that talk down about them with those ridiculous notions, they just don't know.
Speaking of the riders, and we haven't had a chance to, we never finished a recap of the season at Saratoga, but, you know, certainly, you know, one late, or at least the last two-thirds of the meet, the story that emerged was Luis Saez, who, no matter how many times you say, you know, had a great, you know, finish to the meet, the more you watch him, the more you realize that he's got to be in every discussion. And I suppose even if you go, you know, back to last year and all the controversy surrounding maximum security, you know, it's been an extended run at this point for Saez, and he's an elite rider, and I've been a fan of his for a long time. I've told this story a number of times. It was a Wood Memorial Day at Aqueduct, and watched the 3-year-old filly race on Wood Day, Rich.
Well, As long as it wasn't the one day when I got beat on Lloyd Doppler when I rode him with a broken neck.
You know what? I might look it up. It might have been. But he was on. All I have to do is look up the Philly Hot Summer. Saez had come up from Florida with David Fox, and we watched the race together, and he made a move up the rail, and I said, wow. I said, this kid can ride. He said, this kid, and David said, this kid's going to be a big star.
Well, he can really ride, and I'll tell you one other thing. What an amazing person. I mean, this is just a good man. I had the great pleasure of interviewing him in Saratoga, doing my little jockey talk segment, and I laid it out there, you know, just how well he handled the whole maximum security thing. And I just don't think I could have. I don't think to this day I could have handled it as well as he did with the class and the clear-headedness and the ability to put it behind him and go forward. I mean, you know, you just won the holy grail, if you will, in North American racing, the Kentucky Derby, and then to have it yanked from you when... And listen, you know, we can debate whether we thought it should have come down. He certainly bothered horses. The point that I was making when it all happened was they have let so much go for so long in that race that I've seen, you know, just as bad, if not worse, happen. And particularly the first turn, which is just as important a part of the race as anywhere else. And, you know, then for them to make a stand on this day with that incident, you know, that was my only issue with it. Absolutely, he bothered horses. But they had set a precedent of allowing way more to go on within that race than any other race in the history of North American racing. But more to the point was just how he handled it and the class. And what he said to me was, you know, I believe in God. I have a lot of faith. And I always believe that, you know, things happen for a reason. And, you know, God directs you where you have to go. And I mean, just honestly, so much class. Love to see his success. And Saratoga has historically been a meet that if you jump off to a good start the first week, you have a good meet. If you get off to a slow start, you struggle. You know, you're going to win your share, but you don't have as good a meet as you would because momentum is huge up there. For him to miss the first 6 days because of COVID, and then to finish like a house on fire like he did. Now, yeah, he was with Richard DePass a long time, and Richard DePass did a great job, and Richard decided to retire, and, you know, it just worked out perfectly where Kieran McLaughlin, you know, was easing back out of training and then could take, you know, Luis, and just what a phenomenal job that Kieran's doing from carrying on from what Richard DePass, you know, had done for him. But, you know, maybe this is part of the problem, though, when people want to say these things about the Ortizes and what have you, is the depth of young talent in that room that, honestly, there's only so many good mounts to go around, so some guys are just not going to be able to get access to those horses. But you think about the riders in Saratoga this summer, obviously both Ortizes. Joel Rosario was putting on a clinic, particularly early in the meet. Jose Lascano quietly put together an amazing meet. He's been riding tremendously. Luis Saez. Dylan Davis had a breakout meet. Most wins ever in Saratoga, 17. He's been riding lights out, 3 wins yesterday. And I, you know, Junior Alvarado, good, strong rider. And I'm going to feel bad if I leave anybody out. But the point is, the colony's so deep that I think people get spoiled and they don't understand what they're witnessing. You know, there's a time in a rider's life, it's a blend of when physically your youth is on your side, but you're not as experienced. But then you reach a point where mentally your experience kicks in, and there's a window that you're at your optimum physically as well as mentally. And I'm seeing a lot of kids in that place right now, and if they stay healthy, that'll last longer. Like, I always said Bailey was one of the greatest riders I ever rode with. I thought there were a couple guys I might have put above him, you know, and I'm splitting hairs here. But the amazing thing about Jerry Bailey was his prime lasted longer than any jockey I ever saw. His prime was at like a good 16 years where he rode at that level, and he did go a long time without injuries in that period of time, which is key. People don't understand it. You know, you get banged up, you get hurt. And even though you see it and you know what you have to do and what you want to do, your body doesn't respond the same way. like I always feel like my prime was very short because when I broke my neck the first time in 88, I was a good rider and I won races. I was never the same rider again after that accident. I just couldn't be. I saw it. I knew what I needed to do. I was good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to be self-deprecating. But I knew that I had lost something physically that I just was incapable of regaining. I mean, to this day, I've never felt the bottom of my feet since Memorial Day 1988. I used to have to get special boots made so I can curl my toes around the stirrups. You can go to horsephotos.com and look at me on horses. My toes are curled around the stirrups because that's the only way I could grip and hang on to them because I couldn't feel the bottom of my feet. So how could I ever be what I once was after that? And I was, 23 years old when that happened. So
wow.
if a rider could stay healthy and, again, you know, have that window where you're at your peak physically as well as mentally because, you know, you learn to compensate as your physical skills diminish.
Right.
Because you see a race. And you understand, you know, situations and your anticipations better and you know how to exploit other guys, you know, that don't have that experience and put them in compromising positions. But right now at Belmont Park in New York, we have 12, maybe more, riders that are in that place where they're at their best physically as well as mentally.
Now, the funny part of that is that a lot of people seem to be of the opinion that, you know, this era of rider just isn't what this has been going on. I mean, I've been doing this show for 15 years, and I could think about the beginning, and I should probably go look and see who the leaders were in 2005, 2006. And I remember there was this whole theme of where are the good riders going to come from? They'll never be the same quality that we have now that are retiring. It's like, what are you talking about?
but that's a generational thing. I mean,
yes, it's amazing how that gets repeated.
Yeah, I think there's a difference, like in the colony that I came up with in the 80s to these guys. And I think part of it is just the purse money is so different where you know, my first race, I found the overnight recently, Steve. It was a 12-horse field, maiden 25, Belmont Park. 12-horse field, 9 Hall of Fame riders in there. My point being that riders rode every race. They didn't manage their careers. You know, you had Lafitte Pink Eye because he was riding here that fall. Chris McCarron, Shoemaker, in a $25,000 maiden, Angel Cordero, George Velasquez, Jacinto Velasquez. And, you know, it was a $7,500 purse. And guys were going to run you over to win that $7,500 purse. And I just think the purse level maybe has made guys, you know, have the ability, and God bless them. I'm not saying the kids in New York, but, you know, like even Mike Smith and Jerry Bailey during a period of his career where they, well, I don't have to ride. I don't want to ride those kind. I don't want to ride this. I would rather ride that. You know, they could be more choosy and manage their careers better. And maybe that's what led to so much longevity. But, I mean, it was a tough colony, not only great riders, but, man, you better be tough because you can go back to the room and you couldn't be a wallflower. You had to, you know, go in there and fight for what was yours. And you know, Eddie Maple, guys like this, these guys were great, but they were also tough. You know, don't make a mistake. You're going to get punched in the mouth, and you don't see that so much in this generation.
Well, you make me laugh about getting punched because we this summer at Saratoga, I forget how it even came up, but with Nick Santagata and the stories.
What a great guy.
Well, the fight, it was something that happened with him and Tony. I had them on the air together several years ago, and I forget how it even came up, but the topic of who was the toughest guy you guys ever were in the room with, and they both landed on the same guy that they said had been an amateur boxer.
Paul Kalai.
Paul Kalai.
Yeah. No, no, you didn't want to mess with Paul Kaline. You wanted to apologize and put your head down and shuffle off. That's what you wanted to do. And listen, Nick, tough guy. Best jocks room fight I ever saw went three rounds, him and Miguel Ruano.
Yes.
And that was one heck of a fight. They were pretty evenly matched, and Nick was tough, really tough. Nick used to drive me to the Meadowlands a lot. I didn't have a driver's license. I was still living on the back stretch of Belmont. And he would drive me, like we'd get done at Aqueduct, and we'd drive to Meadowlands, and he'd drop me at Belmont at night on the way home. And one night, an older rider, I'm not going to get into names, sucker punched me as I came through the swinging doors into the locker room at Meadowlands, and Nick went after him because the guy could have beat me up on the square. He didn't need to like sucker punch me to begin with, you know? And Nick and him got into it, and Nick got the best of him. And Nick basically laid down the law that night. If anybody wants to mess with this kid, you got to face me first. And so he was like a big brother. He looked out for me.
Well, the fight you're talking about, three rounds, there was a round in the room, there was a round in the showers, and then there was a round the next day in front of the judges.
In the steward's office, everybody that rode that race and was in the room had to go to the hearing the next day. And I believe it was Jerry Burke. Mr. Burke said, "I had enough of this. You two are going to shake hands. It ends right now. You're both getting fined. And that's it. You put it behind you, and it's over." And this is back when you'd walk in the steward's office, your knees would always knock a little. And Jerry Burke was a big, stately man and very tall. And their hands touched, and it was like TNT. It was like an explosion. They started fighting all over. They wound up on the desk. They knocked Mr. Burke over. It was ugly. But it literally was, as soon as their hand touched, it was like a spark. Ba-boom!
Well,
like I said, it's a little different era.
It's a different era, and I think Nick tells the story that I guess they got him, or somebody, maybe you were the one that maybe told the story off the air, that they got separated once, and Nick snuck around to the a back door to the shower room and got him in the shower.
Well, what happened was they start. Back then, Steve, we had one TV in the jocks room back then, and everybody would watch the replay under that TV. It was right by the saddle racks. And, the valets would knock off the saddles so that you had a lot of sand and dirt on the floor there. So they started mouthing at each other, and they started fighting. And Nick slipped because the floor was so sandy. And I would have gave round one to Ruano because Nick slipped. So they pulled him apart. And Nick went back to his corner, and I'm watching him, and he pulled his boots off, and he put his sneakers on because he wanted traction. And he got across the room and got Ruano pinned up against the locker, and he was throwing some haymakers. And Ruano reached up on top of the locker and grabbed the whip and started trying to hit Nick with the whip, hit him across the back, and they pulled him apart. Round two, Santa Gata. So they're tied 1-1, right? Now Nick's furious because Ruano hit him with a whip. And you want to fight with whips? Now, like, it's on. And any grab a boot jack, right? So Ruano's done riding. They sent him to the showers. And now they're keeping Nick out of the back. So Nick goes, "Oh, I'm fine. He goes to, I just got to get a coffee. And he goes in the kitchen area where there's a back door that goes through this corridor down to where the showers are at Aqueduct. And he went there like he's getting the coffee. I think he even started, like, making the coffee up. And then he bolted through that door in the showers. And he's got Ruano down in the showers. And there's a hose that used to run from, they had, like, a faucet that would run through the hot boxes. You could spray the dry room and make it hotter and stuff. And he's hitting him with the hose, yelling at him, "You want to fight with whips?" So they pulled him apart. So round three went to Santa Gata, but he might have got DQ'd. They might have deducted a point. So then the next day they went again in the steward's office.
It's very regularly cited as one of the greatest jockey fight. And Harry Rice, here's the official version: Harry Rice, best fight ever.
Best jockey's room fight I ever saw. Best single punch I ever saw thrown in the room was when George Velasquez hit John Cougay. And told him if something happened in a race, and he told him, if you ever do that again, I'm going to knock you out. And a couple days later, you know, Gino would give it to you. He knew every trick in the book, and he did it again to George, whatever it was. And George came back, took his stuff up, put it down, come on, and squared up and knocked him out. And it was as good a punch I've ever seen. I saw Tyson fight, I think his third or fourth fight at the Egg in Albany. And I had, you know, I was friendly with somebody, you know, that was instrumental in getting Tyson to Customato. And so we were ringside. And that was the best, you know, punch I ever saw. But the best punch, not from a professional boxer, was George Velasquez when he decked poor Gene.
That doesn't even sound like a fair fight. That's just the two of them together. It got to be Georgie all the way.
Yeah, actually, I tell you what, Gene is always so fit, man. He had an 18 pack. He would do 100 sit-ups, 100 push-ups every day in the room before he rode. He was really fit. But Georgie, you know, honestly, the way he squared up and the way he threw that punch and stepped through it, he probably sparred somewhere along the way.
And Harry confirms one punch knockdown.
Yeah, no, it was I was like, oh, I what I just
this is so yeah, great. No,
but that's the big difference. I mean, I think talent wise, these kids are phenomenal. And I'm not going to be the old geezer. Well, back in my day, the only difference is that it was just a bit tougher. And you know, the level of purse. I mean, a maiden allowance race when I started, a maiden special was a $15,000 pot. Hmm. You know, a big race was $25,000. Most of the stakes were $50,000 in New York. And then, like, if you won $100,000 back then, that was a huge deal. I mean, I won my first $100,000 stake as an apprentice in Saratoga, and it was like, you know, unbelievable. Nobody could, you know, an apprentice win $100,000 stake. And, you know, then I guess 81 was the first Arlington Million, which was the first $1 million thoroughbred race. But, you know, just I think maybe that's why guys were just a bit hungrier. You know, the lead rider in the country was going to lead with $5 million, then until Coffin broke the $6 million barrier. Darryl McCarg followed up, who's getting inducted in the Hall of Fame when they, you know, are able to have the induction ceremonies. But, I think that's the only difference that I could lay a finger on. Otherwise, just phenomenally talented young guys that if they stay healthy, they can rewrite the record books.
Well, I have no idea how we ended up in going down this path, but speaking of paths and going down paths, you're out hiking, and you saw where Tina and I inadvertently on Saturday ended up hiking. Now, I'm sure you're well-equipped. I went out there with a pair of Cole Haan loafers, and Tina was wearing flip-flops. I mean, it was ridiculous, and we ended up on this amazing path through the gorge, but you've been there, huh?
Yeah, I've been there. I went when I was on the board for Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. We had a herd not far from there, and I planned it to go inspect the herd and then go for a hike there. So I was very enchanted, very pretty place, beautiful. Yeah, but I couldn't imagine, like, I mean, I have my really good Timberland hiking boots on. I couldn't imagine doing that with loafers and or flip-flops.
As it happens, these are my black shoes. They're very comfortable, and I had no problem, actually, with it. And the problem came, you know, going up and down those stairs, mostly up. You work your way to the bottom because we were up on that, sort of that halfway point, that's what they call the south entrance. And so you go over a bridge, and then you go down, and then you work your way back up, and then over. I was astounded, Rich. And I've also done Chittenango Falls, you know, near Cazenovia, just north of Cazenovia, between Caz and Chittenango, which is really nice, but it's smaller. It's a much smaller stretch. And it's really just one falls. And Ossible Chasm, of course.
Right.
And, you know,
the big man.
yeah. And even that is small compared to this.
You know, it's really pretty over there. I tell you what, Steve, I've taken my fitness level. It's a little crazy how fit I am right now. I've went probably the week before I started back doing the shows on Fox for Naira, I was averaging about 60 miles a week hiking in the mountains, you know, elevation. Like today, I've already done 6 miles, and I'm planning on going to do a 10-mile one right now, and then I'm going to come back down through Poughkeepsie and hit Adams, and I'm making Brace short ribs tonight. So I have my whole day's planned. I'm ambitious.
How about
go ahead.
No, I was going to say the week. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that horse yesterday, Faya on the turf, Bob Masiello.
Yeah.
How impressive was that? I mean, he went 43-1, and his ears were flicking back and forth. I mean, you know, you see horses go fast, usually not that fast, but you watch their demeanor. Their ears are pinned. They're digging in. He did that with his ears flipping back and forth like, you want me to go faster? I mean, that was a freakish performance. And, you know, I'm happy about it because my son Joseph was instrumental in, you know, getting the deal done with Rob. And, you know, got to give Rob a lot of credit, step up and buy a horse like this. And, you know, it looks like they're going to be rewarded with a good one. So I was very impressed with that.
Well, and also happy for the Merrymans as well, you know, who bred and were training. And we'll look forward to talking to Tom Albertrani. And it's, you know, it's interesting with as many route goers as Albertrani is associated with, the long on the dirt, long on the grass, he's very good with these turf sprinters.
He's really good with them. And you know, it's interesting. Yesterday, I was on the desk the first part of the day on the show, and then the last 2 hours I was reporting and doing the paddock report, and his two horses in that race, Duress and Fayed, they looked unbelievable. And basically I said these two are the paddock selections. They looked phenomenal. They wound up running 1-2, so, you know, fantastic job by Tom. And there was another guy who, you know, had the bug right before me, used to be the first call rider for Tresvant Stables, Sue Sedlak. A lot of history. And dating myself, Steve, been in the game a long time.
Well, I'm going to, have I ever sent you that picture of Albertrani on one of his winners, one of his handful of winners?
No, send that to me. I'd like to see it.
Well, there's more than just Tom. There's a groom that you'll get a kick out of. It's hysterical.
Is that Gary?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I wanted to see that. I definitely was it for who was Gary's boss back then before he went on his own? I'm drawing a blank on the man's name.
Fiore.
Was it for Al Fiore?
I've got it here. It used to be my old phone. I showed it to Teal. She got the biggest kick out of it. But that was a couple of summers ago. I'm going to have to dig around. It's one of the greatest.
Yeah, you find it. Send it to me. I'd like to see it. I love that stuff.
Well, the public's got to see. Here it is. Hold on. Here it is. It was for J.B. Morgan.
Okay. Wow.
March 7th, 1980.
So I was about 5 or 6 months before I rode.
You're gonna get the biggest kick out of this. I've got to put it up online, actually. Owner John Sahagian.
Wow.
The horse was Edisto Epic.
I wound up winning 3 or 4 races on that filly. Chestnut filly with a white face.
Yep. Yep. Big blaze.
Yeah,
big wide blaze.
Skippy Shaproff and Bruce Levine.
Well, those from that era, those pictures of Bruce, those are priceless with the big Jufro. He looks like Oscar
Bruce
Gamble. He's the white Oscar Gamble back then.
So funny. Oh, my gosh. That's great.
Go get up on that mountain and and put up the picture tonight of the short ribs, and we will see you at Belmont in the next I don't know, probably we should run pretty soon. We've got we got 4 or 5 horses coming up to run soon, so
terrific. Welcome. I look forward to seeing you. Say hi to Tina for me.
Tremendous, Rich Migliore, and I had a whole separate set of things to talk about, but we blew the turn, basically. It all goes awry. Let's take a break, probably the last of the morning. We got Grant Forster coming up, and one of many people's favorites, as popular an outfit as there is in Kentucky, and Grant. One of those scenarios like Joe Orsino that we talked about with Imprimis coming back from the DQ. Same thing. Pirates Punch. Back after this at the races. Kind of a funny Monday morning. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced, scientifically-based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all 3 PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Sirius XM Sports presents